All right, this week's episode is brought to you by, can you take a guess, John?
Audible.
No, it's actually Onnit. That's typically, or they've been my big sponsor as of lately. Onnit is, you go to waitwhatif.com/Onnit, and I brought this out here so I remember to talk about it. This is my steel mace. So what this is a 15-pound cannonball at the end of a metal pole. And I'm describing it to the listeners. I know that you can tell. And it's for like shoulder mobility, and you can actually get a little bit of cardio out of this. But there's all sorts of exercises. You can actually go to Onnit.com. They have the Onnit Academy, and they have tutorials. You know, if you like stuff that's kind of out of the ordinary, like, well, kettlebells and all those are kind of the ordinary now, aren't they? You see them at most gyms and everything.
Yeah, they're more mainstream now. Yeah.
But that isn't. So, but yeah, you can go and you can find that. You can find things called primal bells, which are kettlebells that have different monkeys or different primates on them. And they're actually really cool. Here, actually, I'll show you a picture of it here. You think I would have had this up, but...
Pictures, they work well on a podcast?
They do. So if you're really interested in seeing what these pictures look like, you can go to www.waitwhatif.com/Onnit. So here's the primal bells. Aren't those wild? They're like, you could just put that in your gym just for like art's sake. And they're perfectly balanced. I can't imagine it would feel good though, taking those teeth across the back of your arm. Do you ever work out with kettlebells or anything?
No, I've watched people work out.
Yeah. Them, they can be, you can hurt yourself if you're not doing it right.
Yeah. It looks like a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. I would expect someone like you would be, going to the gym a lot, hitting up things like that.
I do go to the gym, but I've got a bad back, so I have to be careful.
Yeah, that could mess you up a little bit. Onnit.com. You can also go there. They have food there. They have coffee if you're a coffee drinker. They got some really neat. You ever think about drinking coffee with butter?
No.
Well, apparently there's this whole thing, and I'll do introductions in a minute. Who's on the show? But if you hear someone else laughing in the background. You can take your coffee and then you mix it with grass-fed. They say the best way to do is grass-fed organic butter, just because the other stuff, I don't know, it's got the wrong fats in it. And the best would be like, I don't know, I don't even know the names of the different companies, but you can get it. You can go to any store, you can find this grass-fed organic butter. You put that in your coffee, you put it in the blender, and then it makes this almost like a cappuccino. You get this head on it. It's really smooth and really creamy. And the other thing is you drink one glass of it or one cup of it, and it also fills you up. It gets your metabolism, like it gives you the good fats. Right. Yeah. So it's kind
and
of
you got your fat and for yeah, like the whole week. On
yeah. Right, basically. Yeah. If you can afford the extra, probably 300 calories of butter in your coffee, then I would say go for it. But, yeah. Or you can add coconut oil. They have, if you go to the Onnit website, they have different, recipes. People use coconut oil. They use all different things. So it's kind of one of those, it's a cool website for people that, I don't know, like me, a little bit odd and incredibly good looking. So with that, we will begin the show. All right, welcome to Wait, What If? That didn't sound good, but whatever. My name is Kevin Sullivan. I'm the host, and tonight we have John Taylor back. Who I'm not going to mess up your books this time, like I did last time. So you know what? We won't even mention him. he's an author, former Secret Service agent. You can actually find his books. They're linked on my website at waitwhatif.com. If you go under the section that says books and documentaries and stuff that we talk about during the show, his books will be listed there. Or you can just go on to Amazon and type in John Taylor, I believe, right? And you got a page on there that has your two books on it. And then you can also find him at True Crime Writing. No, yes, truecrimewriting.com. So that's another place. And you have, I think all your links are there too. You can go on. And he's also the host and co-host and creator of Twisted Podcast. So he does his own podcast about everything grim and creepy.
Absolutely.
Basically, have you done a show on the Black Dahlia yet?
I have.
Oh, really? I don't think I heard that one.
It was a book review.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But yeah, we talked a lot about that case.
Maybe I saw a book review and I was like, oh, I'm not going there. And with us tonight is also, I'm not sure if we should say Mr. X or we'll just say Frank. My last name. Frank Constantine, former prosecutor, defense. What else? Firefighter extraordinaire, army veteran,
former English teacher.
And so what we're going to do tonight, every time if you're listening to the show, and you know when John Taylor is on, we always talk about crime, everything crime. And because we're talking to me, who only has time to watch 45 minutes of TV at night, it's usually whatever true crime is available to watch within a 45 minute span. So that always leads us back to making a murderer. And I thought what would be cool is, because Frank came over and we were watching Making a Murderer, I don't know, about 6 months ago. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating show. And I was bringing up different things. And I mean, it's neat to have someone, you know, have a prosecutor in there with you and say, why would they do that? Or why would they do this? So he watched that. And I said, hey, do you want to be a cool idea is getting a prosecutor and a former, I don't know, will we call you law enforcement? Yeah, because you guys enforce law.
That's right.
Former law enforcement slash crime guru, get you guys together and talk about it. Maybe have one of you take the prosecution side when you kind of go to the defense side and see what we come up with. So with that, what'd you think? Did you finish the documentary the second time around or?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't finish the last one.
Okay. What'd you think about it the second time?
The second time it was more interesting than the first time.
Yeah.
Because I was familiar with it.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. It's a weird thing to see something during trial. You're talking about why did they do this? And my whole question is like, why are they doing this now? Why are they talking to the media about the trial? Middle of the trial, they're talking to the media.
Yeah.
Strategy. It didn't make, it made me uncomfortable.
And what's strange about that is there's no lack of, like, I guess you would call it not live, but as it's happening, crime documentaries. You know, there's no lack of those. So these people find themselves, or maybe there's a bunch where people tried to follow along with a crime and a documentary crew and it just stunk and it didn't work out and only the good ones made it through and made it as big as they have. But it's not a rare thing to have someone documenting this in either video or podcast, you know, the Serial podcast as it's happening. Is that what you're talking about? You're talking about
exactly.
When they, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and exactly.
How about like in between, like at the end of a certain phase of the hearing or anything like that, when they would come out, are you also talking about how they handled the media then? Were they giving away too much or is it just specifically with the documentary crew?
Well, no, the media.
Okay.
The media in general, as well as the documentary crew. They're addressing, the defense team is addressing the media people being interviewed, talking about their strategy and their defense strategy. And I mean, that just gives me the creeps. I kept thinking, this can't be real. This has to be scripted. This can't be really happening during a trial. But apparently it was.
Yeah.
You know, I would never do it myself. You have to be very careful what you talk to the media about, what you say.
Sure.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I understand the journalism part.
Mm-hmm.
And wanting to make something real,
mm-hmm.
but you're still representing your client, and you have to be really careful what you say and what you do representing your client.
Because I feel like the documentary crew itself, while they were on, they were more, you didn't hear from anyone. In hindsight, I haven't seen it in a few months, but in hindsight, I feel like they were simply observers. You know, I didn't think they were. Did you remember anything? I think once there was one part you actually heard the the documentarian mention, or he said something to Steven. You saw Steven answer him. And that was the only time I ever saw that. Actually, it was the only time he was interviewed. The whole thing, it was when he was in prison. And I guess we should back up just real quickly. For those of you who haven't seen Making a Murderer, and there's people out there who haven't seen it, you got to check it out. It's really good. You can find it on Netflix. And basically, it's about Stephen Avery, who was wrongfully convicted of a rape back in, I don't know, the early 80s, went to jail for 19 years, was released because they found DNA evidence, and he ended up, I don't know, months later, being accused of murder, and he wound up back in prison. And this is the the whole documentary is 10 episodes of each, what, an hour, maybe more long. So it's a long documentary, but it walks you through the whole process. And of course, it's not a black and white case, so it's perfect for entertainment, or I guess you could say sensationalism. I don't know.
It's sensational. There's yeah. No question. Yeah. You don't get cases like that too often, I think. One of the things that you're talking about the film crew. They didn't inject themselves into it, which was probably the proper thing to do.
Right.
Because they're there to make a documentary. But you have to remember, anything you talk about, there's lawyer-client privilege. Mm-hmm. You're my client, I'm your lawyer. We talk together. They can't make me testify. Nobody can say you have to tell me what was discussed. When you have a third party, there is no lawyer-client privilege.
You're talking about the documentary crew?
Documentary crew, the media, whatever. If you talk about something with somebody else present that's not part of your staff, then that destroys the lawyer-client privilege. Mm-hmm. And you can wind up giving away information. You could actually, I've never seen it happen, but you could actually have real problems with a trial if somebody else is there and they get called to testify. You object lawyer-client privilege. Now, if it's gone, there's nothing stopping them
from
making somebody else testify.
Do you know what I'm thinking, John?
What's that?
With the jinx where they got involved, but you look like you're going to say something. Sorry.
Oh, what I was going to say is just the two defense attorneys from Making a Murderer. They were here in Durham not too long ago, giving a presentation.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
And attended that. And a couple of things they said there was, one was that there was a gag order during the. It's kind of loud.
Oh, is it? Are you getting? Yeah. See,
getting some feedback.
These are quiet. My headphones are quiet, so it's. I can't hear that, but you're hearing that that buzz.
Yeah,
okay.
A little bit.
Let me see. I can do that. I can handle that. That would be testing 1, 2. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the two defense attorneys, the two things they said, one was that during the actual trial, the judge imposed a gag order with the media. So looking back on it, a lot of those interviews that were given were most likely either pre or were before the trial. That there was a gag order. And one of the things they said was that the gag order came in right after the prosecutor, Ken Kratz, gave the talk to the media where he went into all the detail about what happened, even though a lot of it was conjecture on his part. And that since the gag order went in through the entire trial, the only thing the media was playing was Ken Kratz's interview with the media. And that was a real negative for the defense because they weren't able to counter that at all during the trial.
Hmm.
And then another thing they talked about was the attorney-client privilege. And what they said is that the film crew was already there when the two defense attorneys got involved. So they pretty much had to deal with them, but that they would never allow the film crew to be there if they were talking about anything that they felt covered that. So they were pretty concerned about that as well, but they didn't feel like it was an issue. And if you remember in the documentary, not that it necessarily means anything overall, but Stephen Avery was boasting that when he was asking who were the best attorneys in Wisconsin, these were the two names he was given. And rather than picking one, he picked both. So at least as far as reputation wise, these guys were supposed to be the best. But they certainly didn't win. So, I mean, they made some mistakes.
Yeah. Do you think it was winnable?
Not the way it was set up. Yeah. I know they moved it to a different county, but the jurors were all from Manitowoc County. It didn't look winnable to me.
Yeah. What do you think, Frank?
It'd be hard. It'd be real hard because what's difficult is it's a film. I mean, I can't sit down with the case files and go through it and see actually how things progressed. You know, they edited the film.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah,
and you saw snippets here and there and put things together, and they did a real nice job with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a film. It's not. It doesn't go from start at point A and go to point Z,
mm-hmm.
and along the way. I mean, it isn't chronological necessarily. They juxtaposed a lot of things in there. That makes it hard.
Yeah.
It makes it hard to evaluate it. It's very entertaining.
Sure.
It makes it hard to evaluate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically, they're providing you with what they want you to see. But an interesting thing I found about the documentary, listening to the producers talk about it, was that going into this, their thought was that here was a man that's been exonerated of a crime, but he's been in prison for 18 years, and now he's being accused of a murder. Mm-hmm. And what they thought was the most interesting element when they first got into it was they didn't know whether he did it or not. They kind of thought he did, but that if he did it, maybe it's because he was in prison for 18 years.
Yeah, there's that play. Well, the title itself, when I first saw it, Making a Murderer, I was like, what's that about? You know, and then I knew he was in prison, but I didn't know anything else about it. So I automatically went into it thinking, this guy's a murderer, and we're going to see how he became a murderer.
Right. And that was kind of their thought process getting into it. But I think in watching the video, and Frank, you may disagree, but for me, the whole issue, the whole most upsetting aspect of it is, I mean, it's twofold. It's one is just the entire appearance of impropriety of the law enforcement who is involved in the civil litigation, finding the evidence that's ultimately convicts him. And then also how the detectives, who are completely unrelated to the lawsuit, how they treated his nephew, Brendan Dash, who was mentally challenged and under 18, and how they got him to confess. And both of those things, to me, kind of just overtake the documentary as far as the compelling aspect.
Yeah. Didn't I hear something about the mother was actually there, or she had... It wasn't as cut and dry as it seemed on the documentary. So again, for the listeners who haven't seen it, one of the key witnesses also happened to be, well, like you said, he was underage. He was IQ of 70 or something like that. And they brought him in, and you see this a lot, at least you hear about this a lot, where they basically wore him down over a few hours and they got him to confess. But there was, I didn't trust his, I mean, it just, I don't know how he got convicted. He cut a deal, didn't he?
No, he was convicted.
He was convicted.
Yeah,
right.
But the interesting thing, I believe his mother did give some kind of approval or okay for him to be interviewed at some point. I mean, we heard her on the documentary as well, and she didn't come across as being overly educated or knowledgeable of the legal system. But they in Stephen Avery's case, they end up not using his Brendan Dassey's confession as evidence against Stephen Avery because it completely conflicted with the evidence.
Yeah. Yeah, which is that the other thing you brought up, Frank, that here's a murder scene. The kid said that I think she was raped, stabbed, shot in this one room, and yet there was no blood. There were no signs.
That's what Brendan said. It happened in the bedroom. It must have happened someplace else. Clearly it happened somewhere.
Yeah.
But toward the end, the last couple of episodes, they were saying that it happened. The prosecution was claiming it happened in the garage, I believe.
Okay. And, yeah, that's right.
And because they found a bullet,
mm-hmm.
in or at least a fragment in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
Again, though, if it happened, any place it happened, you can't do that to somebody and not have blood all over the place.
Right. And they were tearing up the concrete and looking to see if anything had fallen to the cracks in the garage, and they found nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what they found, as Frank said, was they found a microscopic amount of supposedly Teresa Halbach's DNA, which was the victim, on a bullet casing in the garage.
Right.
And this was a garage. The way the defense attorneys described it at the talk was that the police came in and they took every single item out of this garage and inventoried every single item in the garage. And they're like, this is not a garage that had 10 or 20 items in it. This garage was a mess. They took all those items out, inventoried everything, put it back into the garage. And then 4 months later, they go in and find this bullet. I mean, it doesn't make any sense how that could possibly be there and how it was there from the whole time and they missed it. There's just all the evidence. I mean, the evidence against Stephen Avery is very compelling, in my opinion. But all of it, it just has that element, the fruits of the poisonous tree. Just that there's this the possibility that just something doesn't look right, and I think that anything that could be wrong with that evidence, it could be all thrown out.
There is definitely something strange about the whole case. But again, I think this leads back to Frank's thing there, that it's they cut up, you know, it doesn't go A to Z. It's not, you know, they are trying to compel you to feel one way or another. And it tells a better story than if they just, you know, happened to be doing a documentary on some guy who murdered someone and it was obvious. And then, but there were so many questions, which keeps you waiting for the next episode, purchasing a Netflix subscription. They kind of hint at the idea that the law enforcement side was crooked in this situation, there was the class action. Well, what's that?
Yeah, they didn't hint at it.
They
claimed that they had planted evidence.
Oh, okay.
The key, the bullet, DNA evidence, blood spatter, blood evidence in the car and various places. They came out and said that they had planted the evidence. That's one of the problems. I think that's one of the reasons why he was convicted, because at least in my experience, you don't accuse law enforcement officers of doing something improper unless you can absolutely without question prove it.
Yeah.
Because of the jurors, if you can absolutely prove it, no question about it, the jurors will look at that and they'll punish the prosecution. But if you come one little hair short of that, mm-hmm. where there's any speculation, jurors don't like it, because the law enforcement people are the good guys, and if you haven't absolutely proved it, that's devastating.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And the defense attorneys talked about that, which is they were in a horrible position, which is you don't ever want to have to be the person who's accusing the police of doing something wrong, but they just felt that that's exactly where the evidence was pushing them, and that they had to go with it. But I think you're right. It's a tough situation, and if it doesn't work out for you, that's going to be the ultimate reason why you lost.
I think what they should have done, they should have presented all that evidence and laid it out, but not say in so many words, these people planted this, they had to have planted it. I mean, I look at it and think, my God, you know, they must have planted it, at least some of it. And, of course, the reason why they would do that is because they were convinced that he was guilty and you need maybe more evidence to convict him. But if you can do it, you can effectively put that out to a jury without saying they did it, they planted it. I mean, you put everything together, let the jurors draw that conclusion. I think they went over the line when they said they planted evidence. These are crooked cops, you know. You just don't do that. And I think had they not said that, had they left it up to the jury to put that together with the kind of evidence that they had that looked like it was planted, I don't know how the jury could have not concluded that. And once they do that, then the jurors are in the position of saying, well, we think some of that evidence was planted. Now we may have to look at it and say, well, was he guilty anyway? Even if they planted the evidence, jurors are going to be reluctant, if there's enough other evidence.
Yeah.
They're going to be reluctant to turn somebody loose, but occasionally they'll do that. So it's a tough case, but I just think they went too far.
Yeah, that would be a horrible position to be in as a juror, is if you're in a situation where you think that the police did plant some evidence, but you think he may still be guilty.
Yeah. How do you say that, you know, as the defense, what do you say, like, you know, he got away once, we want to make sure he didn't get away this time, so we planted some evidence just to put the nail in the coffin on this guy. I mean, you can't, I think that's something a jury would buy, but that's, to me, that I think that's what happened. I think they didn't want this guy to get away with that again.
But personally, mm-hmm. I have a problem believing that they actually planted the evidence.
Yeah.
Because I have difficulty thinking that those officers were not just new guys.
Yeah, they were.
And they were good policemen. They didn't have bad records, apparently. Yeah, it's hard to believe that they would have planted the evidence. Could it have happened that way without them planting the evidence? It's possible. Certainly possible. I mean, probably. Is it likely? I don't think it's likely, but it could have.
You know, I think you got to give the police officers the benefit of doubt. Unfortunately, it didn't look like either one of the police officers came across well on the stand, which is unfortunate. It doesn't have anything to do with their integrity or anything to do with what they did. But I think it was Colburn. He wasn't able to answer questions well. Like at one point they were asking him about the calling in the license plate before the car was found. And he couldn't explain that. He did not have it. And there's supposedly a good reason for it, but these guys it didn't look right.
Yeah.
And, so it's very alarming, the whole situation. And to me, if you look at some of the footage they talk about with the civil litigation, and that these police officers were sitting in there denying the fact that Stephen Avery was innocent of the rape, at that point, because they just were like, they just couldn't believe it. They were like, well, that's what they're telling us. They didn't want to accept the fact that they convicted the wrong guy.
Civil litigation, meaning while this is happening, they're still litigating the fact that he was wrongly convicted of rape, and a lot of these officers. So it's a bizarre, I mean, right when you look at that there, this is a bizarre case, because after he's charged with murder and all this is going on, I don't know if this was happening, right? Or did it happen there's two cases going on. Basically, he brought up a lawsuit against the state, right? Or the county.
The county.
What do you call that?
Wrongful conviction.
Wrongful conviction. And he had a good case. I think he had a good case against that. And at the same time, those same officers are now, you know, part of the prosecution to put him away for murder that, again, looks fishy.
That was really wrong. Those officers should have stayed completely away from that investigation. The Manitowoc County officers.
Yeah, that would have cleared up a lot of issues, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just don't do that. Why would you do it? It doesn't make sense.
No, and I think if the two officers, Colburn and Link, that both found a lot of the evidence and both were very instrumental in the wrongful conviction, had they stayed away from the crime scene, I think that you would have never even had any kind of claims of police impropriety.
Yeah.
And I think they showed such poor judgment. And keep in mind, at the same time, you've got the prosecutors and the police out there in the media saying that the Manitowoc police are nowhere near the crime scene.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is being handled by a different police department, and this is what they're saying out in the media. And at the same time, here these officers are going in and collecting evidence and looking for things against Stephen Avery.
Yeah, they had a chaperone or something with them while they were going in. Didn't they have to have?
They did, but the fellow that was with them said that he wasn't watching them completely all the time.
You know? Right. They were just the officers together. It just so happened that they were together. He didn't have any duty to watch them.
Yeah.
They just happened to be there at the same time.
What's fascinating about that too, and I think this is more along the lines, and you might be able to attest to this, Frank, is when you, have you listened to the Serial podcast?
Yes.
When you ask someone what they did, you know, 6 months ago, 3 months ago, whatever it is, on this certain day, yet you can't recall everything. I can't tell you what I did at the office last Wednesday.
Yeah.
I have to look, and that's why I take notes and I look at it and I say, oh yeah, you know, this is what I did. And this is, you have to take good notes in medicine so they can actually go back and do that. But, you're not taking notes every day. You know, the guy who ran the checklist of people, or not checklist, the, sign-in sheet for searching the lot, because the body was found. No, the body wasn't found, but her car was found on a salvage yard lot with thousands of cars. Huge, huge lot. And people were coming in, right? And they were checking in and then doing the search, and then they would check out. And there was something screwy about someone didn't sign out when they said they were going to sign out or sign in. And
I think it was Link who was there.
So Link's one of the officers.
Until later.
Yeah. But you look back, and why did that happen? I don't know. Maybe I came by and he was talking to someone. I said, to hell with this. I'm just going to walk. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know everything. And I guess you shouldn't conduct yourself like that in a situation like that. But who knows?
I think, and John, you would know more than I would. In a murder investigation like that, isn't it just good police work to take notes? Just about everything you do when you're investigating that?
Absolutely. And taking them contemporaneously.
Right. So you can refer to it at the trial, which might be a year or two down the road. I mean, there's nothing more devastating than confronting it, than having a police officer on the stand try to cross-examine him. And he said, well, let me, you know, here's my notes. This, I don't remember for sure, but here's my notes. Well, when did you take those? You know, and I took them at the time. I wrote them down, and here's what it says. And this is what happened. You know, but when the officer can't say that, so, well, I'm just trying to remember 2 years ago or a year ago. And do you have notes? No, I never took any notes. And so how many cases have you done in the past year and investigated? And probably a few hundred. And you remember these details from this one, and you could be mistaken, couldn't you? But, you know, you go through it when they don't have notes. And they don't have any good explanation for not knowing what happened, what they did. The police officer's in trouble. But when they have notes, they're golden.
Yeah, I felt like many of the police actions in this case left a lot of room for reasonable doubt, just based on the mistakes that were made and the processes and procedures they were following. As far as the planning of evidence, I want to give the police the benefit of the doubt, but I don't know if either of you guys are following Catherine Zellner online, but she's Stephen Avery's new attorney. She works with the Innocence Project out of Chicago, and apparently she's supposed to be just this incredible pit bull in the courtroom. And she's been putting out a lot of very cocky information about what she's finding. And basically, you know, at this point, I mean, it's all... She hasn't backed up what she said, but she's basically saying she's identified who the killer is based on cell phone records, and that she's running more sophisticated DNA tests that are going to be able to prove that the police planted evidence, is what she's saying.
Wow.
And one of the tests that she's doing right now, which based on, I think it was a tweet she sent out either yesterday or today, makes me think she may have gotten the results back, but she's saying that there's a test that can determine the age of the blood that basically they found in Teresa Halbach's vehicle. And if that blood is more than, say, 11 years old, which means it should have happened right when the crime took place in 2005, it's older than that, then that blood was planted.
Wow.
And so she seems pretty emphatic about it. I mean, I don't want to get too... Her confidence is obviously, it's very exhilarating, mm-hmm. and it makes you want to believe it.
It's like a sequel.
Right. But... But, you know, she's exonerated something like 40 people.
Wow.
And she's absolutely convinced he's innocent, and that she says she's going to prove it, and that she's going to be able to, she's going to go after and try to prosecute the police officers involved, is what she's saying. But at this point, it's just her kind of, you know, her verbiage.
Yeah.
But to me, it's something I think over the next year or two, I think that there's certainly, if she's got something, we're going to know about it.
Yeah, I'm looking at her site right now. I mean, and then, you know, what's also, I guess she has the history of exonerating all those people. But is she also injecting herself in this case because she knows it's huge and she will have, I mean, she'll go down as like one of the OJ.
Absolutely.
People, I mean, you know what I mean?
Right.
They became celebrity lawyers because they, you know, they handled probably the biggest case in the last 30 years.
Yeah, she's... go ahead.
Wait a minute. You mean, are you suggesting that a lawyer would do something like that? Take a case and make something big out of it?
It's actually... Publicity. It's very... why not, right? You get a big name like that, people are going to say, I want that Kathleen person. Or yeah. What were the names of the... See, I don't remember now. What were the names of the guys in OJ? It was... if you said it, I'd remember it.
Well, there's F. Lee Bailey,
yep.
One of the Kardashians,
yep,
right?
Yep, that's right.
Shapiro. Yeah. Robert Shapiro.
Yep. Yeah. And there was a woman, too, right?
Marcia Clark and Chris Darden, I think,
they were the prosecutors, yeah. Yeah. Well, you remember. I don't remember. Yeah, so apparently it doesn't work for average people like me.
But yes, apparently Catherine Zellner went out and purchased the exact same vehicle that Teresa Halbach has. She's like got her, she just engrosses herself in these cases. I was reading an article on her, and they were talking about how that if she's going to, say, cross-examine a DNA expert, that she will become more knowledgeable in that DNA than that expert, and that she doesn't cross-examine a witness that she doesn't know more about the information than her. And there was a couple attorneys that were describing how going against her in court was worse than going through a divorce. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. She, you know, her going in there to the court appeals.
So she bought the car just to live like her?
Yeah. Just to know everything about that car and what it's like.
Wow.
And it's interesting to note, I don't know if you guys have seen this, there's a little on Reddit and other websites about this case, but if you notice the pictures of Teresa Halbach with her car, she's holding her keys and there's a handful of keys.
Yeah, and they only found the one
clean. They found the one key.
It was,
so where are the other keys?
It had none of her DNA on it either, right?
It only had Stephen Avery's DNA.
Which is bizarre. I mean, that right there, I mean, I guess if you think of chaos theory, anything can happen. But come on, a pristine key without the owner's DNA on it, but the murderer's DNA, unless he scrubbed it clean for some reason, which is plausible. You know, he got blood all over it and he was scrubbing it up.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at pictures of that salvage yard, his trailer and that garage, he doesn't come across as a neat freak.
Yeah.
I can't see that guy thoroughly cleaning anything.
Yeah.
So that I'm a little skeptical of that.
Isn't that, what do you think about that, Frank?
I just think that shows that there should have been blood everywhere, you know, even if he tried to clean it up.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere.
Yeah. So what was the key? That's a huge thing. It's one of those things, yeah. I guess you'll never know.
Yeah.
Right?
That's why we're talking
about, yeah, it,
you know? Frank, what do you think of the interrogation process that took place on Brendan Dassey?
That was awful. You know, that wasn't... They shouldn't have talked to him alone. If they did talk to him alone, they should have stopped when they realized he was someone somewhat limited. Because
that's the PC way of saying it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, he wasn't, I don't think he wasn't intellectually impaired to the extent.
We can say retarded on this show.
He couldn't talk. But at the same time, he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer. And he's only 16 years old.
Yeah.
When you interrogate a kid like that, You want to do it in such a way that you can use those statements later at trial. And when you interrogate a child, a young person like that, and they have limited ability to deal with it, the suspect, you really risk not being able to use anything he says, and that can be critical in a prosecution. So you want to be really careful. They made all kinds of mistakes there, I think, and I'm surprised that he was convicted. I'm surprised they prosecuted him to the extent that they did, because to me it looked like, from what I saw in the movie, of course I didn't see everything, and they don't show you everything. But to me, it looks like he was making stuff up, and it didn't even look like he was there most of the time when he was saying he was giving information. That it sounded like he couldn't have been there.
Yeah.
That was just a strange thing.
Yeah. The thing about that, I mean, is so disturbing to me. One is that the detectives who did that interrogation, they were impartial. They were from another county. And what they did by police standards was a correct interrogation. And those two aspects concern me even more. That this was something that was acceptable and was done by people who weren't involved in the lawsuit, had nothing to gain. They were just trying to get to what they thought was the truth. Mm-hmm. That really concerned me about it. Also is that Brendan Dassey was Stephen Avery's alibi. And so the police were all over him from the beginning. And they were constantly trying to break down that alibi. And that's how they end up getting into that, to the confession part, was because they were like, well, we have to get rid of his alibi. Of course, in the 1985 rape case, he had 16 alibi witnesses, and they didn't have any problem going after him with them. They just ignored him. But here, they felt like they were going to get rid of him. And so, to me, the fact that it was an acceptable interrogation, as Frank said, I was really surprised they used these tapes in the courtroom.
Yeah.
I felt like it showed more, not necessarily innocence, but just sheer confusion on the part of Brendan Dassey than it did a confession.
Yeah.
As Frank pointed, and you can tell, he's just at times guessing.
And, yeah, yeah.
And one of the things, if you ask, is name one piece of evidence that Brendan Dassey put forth during any of those interrogations that was not already given to him. And I don't know of any piece of evidence or information that he provided that the police hadn't already given him.
Yeah, that when they were getting him to say that they shot her, he didn't know that he was shot. And he said, "When did you shoot her?" And then he put that in there and said,
"Who shot her? Who shot her?"
Oh, is that what it was?
Shatter, yeah. And the disturbing thing about that is that was information that had not been released publicly. They always hold back some information because you get people that come in to anytime there's a crime, they get people that come in and confess to the crime. And one thing, you can't tell whether they did it or not sometimes. And generally, policemen don't want to be prosecuting people who didn't do the crime.
Yeah.
So one of the ways they do that is to withhold information, some details of the crime that only the person who perpetrated the crime would know. And if they don't know that, they can weed them out. This one, they had not released publicly that she had been shot. I believe she was shot in the head.
Right.
And Brendan apparently didn't know that. And they were trying to coach him, trying to get him to say it. You know, what else? What else? What else? There was something else. Do you remember? There was something else. He made two or three statements.
Yeah, it was just inventing guessing, things. Yeah.
And then finally one police officer got frustrated and said, "Who shot her?" Right? And then the kid said, "Well, you know, Steve shot her."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't think he knew anybody shot her. Didn't look that
way. Do they do it for fame or just mental health?
Who?
The people who actually come forward and admit to things that they didn't
they're,
do.
They're nutty.
Yeah.
You know, you get people that'll come in every time there's a crime. They come in and I mean, police get to know these people.
Yeah. Too. Oh, so it's...
right.
You know, they'll come in and admit every crime going that they know about.
Especially famous crimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's they're mentally unbalanced.
There's...
But once in a while, you get somebody who comes in who isn't known to the police, and there's a real... You wonder if they really did do the crime. That's one of the methods they can use to weed these people out.
Yeah. There's a famous case where they... I wish I could remember. It was like some sort of rape molestation case. There might have been. They were trying to get this guy to admit to the crime, and they found out at the end. It was after they convicted him. Someone went in and said, "Oh, tell us about, you know." They made up this whole part of it. Tell us about this part of the crime. And they went in with a fictitious story, and they got him to actually admit to that part of the story. And then it turned out this guy was just a kook. He actually didn't do it. And I wish I knew more than just saying that, but I heard it. I think it was on the Joe Rogan podcast, the most recent one with Sam Harris. They were talking about it. Just the ability to put false memories in people's heads, or yeah, for these people to just, you know, like you said, admit to things.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in the Brendan Dassey case, and the technique the police are using, I think it's called the Reed technique. And I was taught that in training a long time ago. And it's a compelling technique, and it's designed that basically that people do tell the truth, and that basically once you figure out that someone's lying, you have to go after them until they admit the truth. And that's kind of the whole concept.
So they admit they are lying?
They give you the real information.
Okay.
And so you're trying to identify the indicators of deception and lying. And then once you get them, then you go after the interviewee. And the problem with that, I mean, one is that there's no perfect way to tell whether somebody is being deceptive or not. And so you're kind of, you got a false assumption to start with. And then they're basically going until they get that admission. And as you can tell here, they keep setting it up in scenarios that make it easier to confess. And they're telling Brendan Dassey, you know, if you just say X, Y, and Z, then you can go to class, which is a lie.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing, is they're wearing these people down. And, you know, if you're younger or you don't have the strong mental capacity, it's easier to do it to somebody. But basically, you're getting someone into a situation where they're only out. The only way that they think they can leave this interview is by saying what they want them to say.
Yeah, all right, I did it.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, oh, sure. Yeah. And a lot of times, they don't even get you to admit to the actual crime. They'll say, okay, it wasn't a baby, it was a doll.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you did to the doll, or something like that. And they just slowly try to work the person. And supposedly that gets to the truth. But, you know, I mean, a lot of people have problems with this because of the amount of wrongful convictions and false confessions. But you mentioned the first season of Serial. And one of the problems I had is there was a witness, Jay, who that case is actually going back to trial, so he's going to come back into it. But this witness is lying to the police, but eventually he tells them what they want to hear, and he's instrumental in getting this guy convicted.
Yeah.
But the whole time during listening to that series, I'm thinking, how do the police know which parts are true and which parts are lies? Because he's lying, then he's supposedly telling the truth. And I felt the same way with Brendan Dassey. If you've got 15 versions of the story, how do you know that the 15th version is the truth? And I feel like there's just so many different stories going on with using this process that it's the police's discretion to determine which one is what they think is the truth. And that if that's the confession or the admission at that point.
Makes it a lot harder to prosecute somebody when they do that, when it comes out. Yeah. And understandably, you know, it's...
Yeah, they seem to just kind of ignore... I mean, I understand that maybe somebody lies and then tells the truth, but they seem to just disregard all the other statements, and they only focus on the one that they consider to be accurate.
Yeah, that's because they're admitting to the crime.
Right.
Yeah. It's fitting the narrative.
Yeah.
They can make good politicians.
And sometimes it is true. A lot of times
right.
It's true.
It is effective at times.
But sometimes it's probably not true.
Yeah, I think the wide net that you're casting to catch the criminals is picking up a few that aren't criminals as well.
That's what we're supposed to be weeding out, though, too. You know, the burden of proof. It's, you know, the idea it's better to let 10 innocent people go than, or 10 guilty people go than to convict one innocent person, that whole thing.
Yeah.
The burden of proof is very high, and it should be. But it makes you wonder how many wrongful prosecutions or wrongful convictions there are, especially with this Innocence Project going, and they've got quite a record. The capital punishment now is a big issue just for that reason, because there's been so many people, a number of people that...
Right. You can't undo that.
Yeah.
How do you... I know we've talked about it before. Your thoughts on DNA evidence. And I want to bring this up because I know you have... you've been researching DNA evidence a lot, but...
I haven't done that much with DNA evidence. So one... The last case I had that dealt with DNA evidence was a rape case, and we sent in New York State. We sent a sample to the state police lab in Albany, and it came back, and there was something like a 67% chance that, according to the DNA, that the guy was it was his DNA, the defendant's DNA.
Still, that's not that great.
My impression at that time was that it was more like it's either, you know,
98%
or it's zero. But that was quite a while ago too. I don't know the state of DNA evidence right now. I just haven't looked at it in a few
years. Yeah, I mean, there's always the human error element with it. And, you know, my biggest concern is that, like, with a fingerprint, if there's a finger, your fingerprint's at the crime scene, there's a really good chance you were there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very hard to explain how your fingerprint got there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone's DNA can be anywhere.
Sure.
And especially when you're talking about microscopic levels. I don't know how, you know, you could ever explain that. But, I mean, Kevin, you go to a gym. I mean, think about all the DNA you're picking up on your gym bag and bringing back to your house from everyone at that gym.
That's true.
And all their DNA is in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anything happened here, how those people could ever try to explain that they weren't here?
Yeah.
You know, they're done. Right.
I guess you could, as a defense, you would have to, you know, at least lay that out, how DNA can be transferred. You know, if you looked in and the person that I'm charged with murdering also went to the same gym, or I guess that doesn't, because that would happen a lot. There's a lot of people murder people they know. So, I don't know. That's a weird one.
DNA evidence, too, is very complicated. And they have a DNA person, DNA expert, a scientist come in and to explain, to testify as to the results. There's a lot of statistics in there. And I look at it and I think, well, I'm following this. But, you know, it's not like, John, you mentioned fingerprints. You can put a picture of the fingerprint up in front of the jury and you can put a picture of the guy's finger print that was made here. You can compare both of them. You can see that they look the same. DNA evidence, the jury can't sit there and see that this DNA evidence is the same as this DNA evidence.
Exactly.
And
it's kind of
a leap there.
Right. You just have to trust the expert.
Right.
You can't really validate it yourself. Unlike a lot of things, you can look at it and at least come to some kind of reasonable understanding. With DNA, the statistics are way too complicated, and you pretty much just have to take the expert's word.
And when people hear that, they say, "Oh, DNA evidence, it has to be right," because people in their mind think, you know, it's they found a piece of hair from you and it's matched up perfectly. It doesn't work that way. So, I mean, as a juror, if I heard that, let's say I'm, you know, Joe Schmo who mops the floor every day, and you know, I'm not into science, I don't read science books or anything, and someone tells me DNA links this person to the murder scene, from what I know, that means he did it.
Right.
Yeah, I think though that as a prosecutor, you would want more evidence than just DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, I would be worried if all I had linking a defendant to the crime was DNA evidence, small amount of DNA. The jury's, the defense is going to really attack that.
Yeah.
And the jurors are going to think, why would there not be some other evidence of a crime? And you know, if a person does a crime and the police do their work properly and the prosecution does their work properly, there should be enough evidence of that crime to convict that person.
Yeah. Shouldn't even go to trial if they do their job right.
Yeah. Sometimes there's no choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think a good ethical prosecutor can cut through a lot of these issues. Somebody who's not looking just to win, but to uphold justice. And I think when I was watching Making a Murderer for the first time, and they said that they were going to appoint a prosecutor from another county, my initial thought was, okay, this is going to get things back on track. You know, this the police may have done some stuff, but this prosecutor is not going to stand for that. And then, and I hate to be, you know, that first impression, but here's Ken Kratz coming out there, and it was like 5 seconds of him talking. And you're like, oh, this isn't good.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I just immediately, and I hate that because I know that I have that bias, mm-hmm. but it was just immediately, there's just something about this guy. I don't trust him immediately. And I think that turned out to be for a good reason. But to me, I felt like on this case, had they had a good prosecutor come in and really work this case, I think it could have been a lot better. But, you know, he did nothing but take it down a notch.
I think that's sad, too. It doesn't need to be that way.
I'm just going back into my notes here.
Was he guilty or not guilty, John?
I mean, like I said before, I think that the as far as the burden, the criminal burden beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't think they reached it. Whether I think he did it or not, it looks fairly compelling with the evidence, but. So you know, coming out of the documentary, I kind of felt like he probably had something to do with it, but he got a really bad, you know, it really shined poorly on the justice system. But, you know, now I'm kind of withholding judgment, waiting to see what Catherine Zellner is going to come back with him.
Yeah, I agree. I've had jurors tell me after not guilty verdicts, well, we think your client is guilty of sin, but, you know, the prosecution just didn't prove it.
Yeah.
They have to prove it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think he did the crime, but you couldn't tell by that evidence for sure. And we wanted to be sure.
Yeah, and that's the right answer from a juror.
That's the way it should be, yeah. That's the way. Because if everybody did their job right, there should be enough evidence. And the jury should be able to look at it, convict the person, and go home and sleep that night. The last thing jurors, and I've interviewed a lot of jurors after trials, the last thing they want to do is go home wondering if they've convicted somebody improperly.
So after you're allowed to, you get time with the jurors? And
you can. If they want to talk to you after the trial, you know, after the verdict and the conclusion, yeah, you can talk to them then. I don't, that's true in New York and Pennsylvania. I don't know if that's true in every state. I assume it is, but I don't know that.
I imagine they would want to. I would want to.
Some do, some don't.
Yeah. I guess some people just want to get on with their lives.
Yeah. But it's interesting talking to them.
Yeah. Well, because they can tell you right away what.
And they're real conscientious. They listen. When I first trial I did, I heard the judge's the charge to the jury, where he explains at the end of the trial, before they send the jury out, the judge gives the jury charge, and he goes through the law and explains everything, burden of proof, what the crimes, the definition of the crimes, and everything. Sometimes it takes a couple of hours for a judge to do that, and I thought, my God, you know, these people, they're not lawyers. They haven't, a lot of these terms they've never heard before. How are they ever going to remember anything? And you wonder how they stay awake. And yet, when they go into the jury room, there's 12 of them, they pretty much remember all this stuff. And a lot of it's common sense, but they look at those charges. They look at the definitions of the crimes. And they'll debate that, and they'll, and if there's a missing element, if they haven't proved an element, they'll generally pick it up. And I was really impressed with jurors. how much attention they pay. And you get 12 of them together. They all remember different things, apparently. But together, they remember quite a lot. I mean, the important things, for sure.
Yeah.
And they'll turn people loose if they think that the prosecution hasn't met its burden.
Yeah. Ever prosecute a case as interesting as this?
No, not prosecuting.
Yeah,
I've never been involved with a case quite that convoluted.
Yeah, as a lawyer, and I don't know. I mean, if you can't answer this question, just let me know, and I'll take it out. But as a lawyer, if someone comes in and says, Mr. Constantine, or not even that, someone calls you from prison, says, "Hey, I need a lawyer. You know, it's such and such a case." Do you, let's say you research it and you say, wow, this guy's guilty. Or even if you're a public defender and you sit down with the client, you're talking with them, and in your head you're saying, this guy's guilty of sin. I don't believe a thing he's saying, but now you have to defend him. How do you pull yourself away from that?
There's two things really that touches. One is your own personal feeling, and you just learn to put that aside. Mm-hmm. It's irrelevant whether they're guilty or not. Whether they actually did the crime. What you worry about, what you look at is, can the prosecution prove that my client did this crime? What evidence do they have, and you know, how will it go at trial? The other thing is, when people have a right to testify in their own defense, mm-hmm. they have an absolute right. You can't tell them you have to testify or you can't testify. That's their choice. And I always told people, look, you have a right to testify. And if you want to testify, I'll put you up on the stand and you can tell the jury your side of the story. And I would always ask them, now, do you want to testify first? Some people just say, no, there's no way I'm going to testify. I'm terrified. I would not do a good job. And other people say, yeah, I want to testify. Well, I would always ask, like, well, what do you want to say? And then a lot of times you get the most amazing stories, and you know that they're making things up. And not everybody. I mean, some people tell you the absolute truth, and I've had cases where people were truthful. We went and got a not guilty verdict. I've had other cases where you hear what they're going to testify to, and you think, my God, you know, if this guy testifies to this, he's going to convict himself. Nobody's going to believe this fantasy.
Yeah.
And so then what do you tell them? I mean, I don't tell them that, you know, I have no point in insulting them. I just always would say, well, I understand this, and you know, that it could have happened this way. But you know, we're going to have a jury of 12 people from wherever, and they're going to have a hard time thinking that that's true. They're going to have a hard time believing you on that. So, you know, you can testify, and you can testify to just what you told me, but be aware that they may not believe you.
Yeah.
And I never, what you can't do is coach them to change it and say something else, or try to figure out, tell them what they should be saying to make it believable.
Sure.
I mean, you can't do that as an attorney.
How do they practice then? Or is that for their witnesses?
How do they?
Because don't people go into the court and like rehearse as if it's a play? You know, they go in and they go over the questions, and this is how we're going to ask you. And actually, they showed it on, was it Making a Murderer or was it another one? It might have, gosh, I want to say it was.
You have to prepare the witnesses, your witnesses. You want to know what they're going to say before they go in to testify.
Yeah.
If you don't know what a witness is going to say before they testify, then you really shouldn't be putting the person up.
Because okay.
They could be a good prosecution witness if you're the defense.
Yeah.
Or the other way around. You have to prepare them, but you always have to ask them what happened, you know, and you can take notes, and you can't lead them into saying something or correcting things that don't make sense. Mm-hmm. But you have to be aware of what they're going to say generally. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it changes, sometimes innocently. On the stand, mm-hmm. you know, they make mistakes. Like any, some they get people get nervous and they can't remember things that maybe they told you before. You can refresh their memory. defendants are a little bit harder because they're the person that's on trial. You have to be careful not to suggest things. You have to be aware of what they're going to testify to, how they're going to testify, and you want them to be responding to your questions, because when they're on the stand, that's direct examination. You can't suggest things on. You have to ask open-ended questions. Now, you also prepare them for the prosecutor cross-examining them.
Mm-hmm.
You do the same thing. You can cross-examine them in your office. You know, so this is what the DA is going to ask you, what's mm-hmm. going to be your response. But you have to be careful not to suggest to them answers. But you have to be aware of what they're saying, what they're going to say. It's a trick.
Yeah.
It's a trick. Whether I've had numerous cases where I thought the person probably was guilty, never ask. Doesn't matter to me whether they were guilty or not. If I'm defending them,
yeah, you look at. So basically, you take the puzzle and you're looking at the puzzle pieces. The end game is to complete the puzzle, and if you have enough, I mean, you know what I mean. If you're missing pieces and they're not being forthcoming to you, that's not your problem. You don't have those pieces, you can't do anything with it anyways.
Well, you have to assume they're being honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're not, and that comes to haunt them at trial.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're absolutely honest, and it absolutely helps them.
Do you ever just ask them, did you do it?
No, never. No. Not once. Not once. Oh. I've had at least 36 serious felony trials, and I mean, I've had hundreds of defendants represented. I've never asked one, you know, did you do this? No, there's no point to it. I don't need to know. If everybody did their jobs properly and this person is guilty, they're probably going to be convicted.
Mm-hmm. And you go to bed then with the, so how about the sure. people that are obsessed with winning? That's the, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, we're all obsessed with winning.
Right. But if I guess that you answered the question because you don't.
It wouldn't matter if I knew for sure. If I knew absolutely without a doubt this person was guilty, no matter. Doesn't matter. I'm going to go in and do the best I can to give this guy the best defense and hope that I can get a not guilty verdict.
Right.
It's not my job to present evidence against him. It's not my job to convict him. That's the DA's job. And if everybody did their job right on his side,
mm-hmm.
they're probably going to convict them.
And if they're not convicted, that's just the process.
That's the process. If they're not convicted, I mean, you know, I would explain to juries, the DA has to prove these three elements of this crime. If he doesn't do it, that means that one of two things: either the guy didn't do the crime, or it wasn't a crime, or he didn't do it, or somebody screwed up in the prosecution, and they're not putting it together properly. Either way, how do you know this guy's guilty? If they screwed up and didn't present a proper case and can't prove this crime, can't prove my client did it, then how do you know he did it? You don't know. That's why we have a trial.
Yeah.
So if you convict my client based on you think maybe he probably did it, but there's a missing element or there's weakness here, there's reasonable doubt on one of the elements of the crime, but you convict him, how do you know that he's actually guilty? Because if he were actually guilty, there'd be all these. And you can do that when you see a weak element, when there's a real lack of evidence. But the reality is, if they can't convict him, if they can't produce enough evidence, then either the guy didn't do the crime, or it wasn't a crime. It doesn't amount to a crime. Or the police screwed up. And he is guilty, but the police messed up, or the DA messed up.
Right, and the answer is not guilty. You're not necessarily finding him innocent. That's just finding him not guilty.
Okay, yeah.
That's
not
a distinction.
Yeah, it's not a finding of innocence.
And
yeah.
Frank, as far as you've been on both sides, which side are you more partial to, the defense or the prosecution?
I've done both. I liked doing trials. Okay. I liked doing trials, prosecuting and defending. I'm probably partial to the prosecution.
Because you got to carry a badge.
I got to carry a badge. And one of the things that I discovered, I was a defense attorney for a good 10 years before, no, longer than that. At least 10 years before I was a prosecutor. Mm. And one of the most delightful things that I found was having police officers as my witnesses and putting a police officer on the stand and being confident that he was telling the truth and that he wasn't making anything up and he had his notes and he was accurate and honest and this is the way it was. This is what happened and this is why I'm testifying to it. Because with criminal defense witnesses and criminal defense defendants, not always, but it's not unusual to have people spinning stories. And that's really hard to deal with when you're trying to present a case. And working with the police officers is really a joy. The hard part was leaving the prosecutor's office and going back to defense work, which I did, and having to cross-examine police officers because I like police officers. Mm-hmm. And that was difficult. I did it. I did a good job of it, but it was harder. It was harder once I had been a prosecutor. In fact, I kind of shied away with the types of cases where I would have to do that. The most of the cases I handled after being a prosecutor were drunk driving cases. I did some drug cases and various other things, but nothing like I had done previously. And the good thing about drunk driving cases is most drunk driving charges or defendants are decent people, by and large. They're not criminals. They're honest. They know they did something wrong. They just want to be treated properly, and they want a break if you can get them a break. And that's not true with hardened criminals. And the police officers with drunk driving cases are generally, you know, they don't take any joy in prosecuting these people because most of the defendants are decent people. You know, it's not like somebody's committed a terrible assault, you know, and you want to get that person.
Right.
Police officers are generally not trying to hurt these people. They just don't want them drinking and driving.
It's an interesting perspective. I've asked many people who have been both prosecutors and defense attorneys. Normally, it seems like they go from being a prosecutor to a defense attorney. It sounds like you kind of did defense, prosecutor, then defense again.
Correct.
And the most common answer I usually get is that when you're a prosecutor, you pretty much thought everybody was guilty. And so it was kind of like a one direction. That's what you're doing. You're going after these people. The police are honest. These people are lying. I'm trying to prosecute them. And then you become a defense attorney and you're like, well, wait a minute. Not everybody is guilty, and some of these people actually are, you know, getting the short end of the stick here, and you know all that confidence that I had in the system and how this was working out is now somewhat there's a little kink in it because now I'm seeing people who are wrongfully charged and whatnot. Now that's not all of them, but you see it.
It happens,
and it changes that perspective. But you seem to have a much more balanced approach, which
I went into prosecution after having been a defense attorney for at least 10 years. And I did all kinds of different cases. I mean, I had murder cases and, you know, simple assaults. I mean, everything in between. And then when I became a prosecutor, it was a real advantage to have been a defense attorney because I'd seen everything and done everything on that side. And so as a prosecutor, I could look at cases and know what the defense was going to be, you know, how they're going to handle these people and things like that. So there was no baloney, you know. I mean, I know when defense lawyers are spinning yarns talking to, you know, you try to resolve every case. You don't want to go to trial on every case because you'd never have time to do anything else. So you try to resolve things. Well, I could tell when a defense attorney was being upfront with me and when he wasn't. And that was a real advantage. And then, and it was fun. I mean, it's fun on both sides. Hard, but fun. And then when I left the DA's office and was doing defense work again, it was an advantage to have been a prosecutor, because I knew that side, and I could talk to prosecutors, and I would never try to buffalo them. I mean, this is the way it is, and we had a really good rapport, even with guys that I didn't know. I mean, I did work in a number of different counties, and some of the prosecutors I just didn't know, but I always let them know that I had been a prosecutor, and there's a rapport there, and you can generally get a lot better treatment for your client if you deal with prosecutors honestly and you don't try to buffalo them, and they know you were a prosecutor, and you can work things out and to your client's benefit. And that's the way I looked at it. And occasionally you have to go to trial, though. And when you do, you go to trial, and if you have to embarrass a police officer, you do it. You know, it's just part of your job. If you have to embarrass the DA, you do it because it's part of your job. I don't know how you could do anything else. But if my client was guilty or not, I don't need to know that.
Good answer. Well, we've been at it for an hour and 10 minutes, if you can believe that. I thought it was a good conversation. Anything you want to add in there? Been meaning to bring up, or
no? I think Frank brought some interesting points. I like that he's been on both sides, so yeah. You definitely get a very balanced perspective on things.
Sure, I would think you would have. Well, you don't have to. Obviously, there's people that make their careers out of being defense and prosecutor. But if you, to me, it makes you, or it would make you, a well-rounded attorney if you have been on both sides of it.
It's an education either way.
Yeah,
and it's not easy. I was a little older when I became a lawyer. I was in my mid-30s. So I'd done a number of other things. So I wasn't just out of law school and thinking every client that came in was being railroaded, you know?
Yeah.
And because that's just not the case. Occasionally you get people that honestly are not guilty of the crime. And generally, my experience has been when I had people like that, I think, because I never asked, but I think those people were the ones where we got not guilty verdicts. I don't think there's too many. I've had probably 12 or 13 out of the last 14 trials I did with not guilty verdicts. But I don't think I fooled any juries.
Yeah.
I think probably it was because they were indeed not guilty for some reason. Not guilty being not innocent, but right. Not guilty.
Right.
Either they didn't quite prove the case, mm-hmm. or they just didn't do the crime. Part of it was because after doing a number of cases of representing a number of people, you get to be good at which ones you bring to trial.
Mm-hmm.
You want to encourage people to take pleas when it's appropriate, but sometimes the plea offer just doesn't make sense and you have to go to trial. And if you get somebody who's really not guilty, who didn't do the crime, you got a good shot at it. Or if the police or the DA messed up, then you have a good shot at it. And again, if somebody messed up, it should be a not guilty verdict, because you can't tell whether they're guilty or not. If you can't tell, it should be a not guilty verdict.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. It was challenging.
It's fascinating how our system works.
It is.
It's a really neat system.
It's a good system.
Yeah.
It's hard to put a percentage on it, but I would say 98% of the people that are found guilty are actually guilty.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot of people that are being convicted wrongfully.
Well, if you go on Twitter, they'll think the opposite.
Well, when you get 300 million people in the country,
and
you get the number of trials and criminal cases that we have in the United States,
yeah.
even 2% or 1% is going to be quite a number of people.
Yeah.
But they even generally get weeded out later. John, what were you, Secret Service, right?
Yes.
What were you involved with?
Primarily protection. So presidential protection, vice president, foreign dignitaries, but also did intelligence investigations. So looking into threats against the president or other protectees. And then we did some white collar crimes as far as bank fraud, credit card fraud, check fraud, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Did you protect the Clintons?
I did.
Or are you not at liberty to say? Did you know the guy who wrote the book?
You know, I don't recognize his name, but I'm pretty sure that I was at the White House the same time he was.
Okay.
So I think I probably came across him, but I didn't recognize him or his name.
Are you going to give the Wait What If podcast an exclusive?
Yeah, I mean, my feelings are, there are certainly things that you come across that you don't agree with and would love for the public to know, but yeah. I think it's part of the job that you just don't divulge those publicly, so mm-hmm. I'm not really supporting what he's doing. I mean, I understand why he does it, but I just wouldn't do it because I just don't think it's right to provide information that people think is private when it's going on.
Sure. Because, I mean, yeah, I guess as a president, you have to have security there, and yeah, I guess it kind of would suck to know that every time you're saying something, there's someone there that could potentially blow the whistle on it. Is there any way, like, do you guys have any, like, I don't know what it's called, like a privacy?
I just heard that they're making people sign non-disclosure agreements.
Okay.
But when I was in the service, there was absolutely nothing like that. I mean, it's an honor and integrity thing. I mean, obviously you can't divulge classified information, but I mean, what somebody does or someone says to you that's offensive isn't necessarily, that doesn't have anything to do with classification. That's just basically, you know, keeping the respect of the people that you're around.
Well, there's a degree of professionalism
right.
that I think you have to maintain.
And it's not easy.
I admire that. Probably not easy, but
yeah.
That goes with the job, I would think.
Yeah, there are a lot of foreign dignitaries, at least when I was working, that certainly weren't respectable people that in their own country, you know, later became, they'd been charged with crimes and very heinous acts that they did that you have to put your life on the line for them at the time. And
yeah,
you kind of just have to look past that.
Yeah, that's the job, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's. I need to have you on the show just to talk about that.
Yeah,
we need to do a Secret Service show. You got good stories?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot going on that time. So I was under Clinton and then George W. Bush. So the transition, and you know, Gore was vice president at that time, and so there was a lot going on. And you know, obviously Hillary was first lady. So now that she's running for president, you know, she's much more relevant as well. Where mm-hmm. at that time she wasn't even an elected official; she just had protection because of being married to the president.
Yeah. Like when she landed in Kosovo and was under sniper fire. It can't be that good of a job. No comment. I was going to give a special shout out to Miss Case because she's one of my biggest followers on Twitter. What's her first name?
Nikki.
All right. Well, here's your shout out, Nikki. I guess people can follow you at I don't know what they can follow.
The in case.
The what?
The Miss Case.
The Miss Case.
On Twitter.
You could follow her at The Miss Case. What are you working on? Anything? I know you were doing the DNA thing. You got the Twitter podcast.
Yeah,
podcast.
I'm working on a case, a young man, 19-year-old named Praveen Verghese in Southern Illinois. He was a Southern Illinois University student, and he died a couple years ago. And the official autopsy was environmental hypothermia. Mm-hmm. Basically, they found him in the woods in the middle of the night, and they assumed that he had frozen to death because it was about 2 degrees out that night. However, the family, when they saw the body, they saw a lot of injuries and they became very suspect. And so they commissioned a second autopsy, and the pathologist for the second autopsy found blunt force trauma to the head as the cause of death. And the state's attorney, which is the equivalent of a district attorney in Illinois, has basically refused to prosecute and has basically locked his position in that he's not going to do anything on this case and that it's very clear that it was accidental. But the family has been strongly pursuing it. And I got involved. Somebody that I knew in college, a friend of hers, is active in this case. And so I've been in kind of like a consultant role, getting on this case, looking at the evidence, trying to find out if, you know, what happened and what we can do to move forward. It's a fascinating case. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's certainly not straightforward. And, you know, he's got a grieving family that is looking for answers. They just want to know what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, how did their 19-year-old son, who's in college in a town, you know, walk into the woods in the middle of the night and end up freezing to death?
Yeah.
And you got people coming forward, a guy, you know, claiming he got in a fight with him. He did punch him prior to going into the woods. But the state's attorney doesn't seem to put any credence on that kind of, you know, what transpired prior to him going into the woods. So it's a case I'm looking into. It's ongoing. There's a lot of things still going on. I think they got something like 40,000 signatures to try to compel the state's attorney to move forward on this case, but he's pretty much locked in his position with the claiming that the autopsy pretty much ends the debate. However, the first autopsy that concluded hypothermia, but there's no medical evidence to support it, which is there's no frostbite. There's nothing stating that the body actually, that the person froze to death. They've made the conclusion solely on the circumstances of the case, which was that he was found in the woods and he was found partially undressed, which is what they call paradoxical undressing. It's like one of the late stages of hypothermia. Yeah. That you think you're getting warm and you start taking your clothes off.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the pathologist came to the conclusion solely on the fact that he was, you know, found in the woods during a cold period of time and that he was partially undressed, and just completely discounted any kind of injuries that he had on his body.
No alcohol or drugs in his system?
Well, the toxicology reports came back negative to both, that he didn't have anything. However, everyone that was around him that night, almost everyone, claimed that he was highly intoxicated.
Okay.
But the second pathologist was saying that he thinks that he didn't die quickly, that he may have died 12, 24 hours later.
Well, his body, yeah.
Would have given him time to metabolize the alcohol.
Hmm.
So it's an interesting case. It's ongoing, and hopefully we can get some kind of positive resolution in that case.
Hmm. Very interesting.
How were you involved with it? How did you get involved?
Just like I said, there's a woman that's pretty active. She was a radio show host in Southern Illinois, and she's been pursuing this case since the beginning. And she's a friend of a friend. So basically, she was told, hey, there's this guy that's a true crime author, and he looks into cases that are unsolved, and this is what he does, and maybe he can help you.
What are you doing to look into it when you say you look into it?
I've gotten a tremendous amount of information on the case. I've gotten the interview tapes. I've gotten all the interview transcripts of the primary people involved, police reports, surveillance videos, the toxicology reports, all the pathologist reports and that kind of stuff, and just analyzing it and breaking down and trying to determine what I think happened or likely happened based on the evidence that I've seen.
How do you get police reports?
They through Freedom of Information Act, the family got all this information. So I was able to get it that way.
That would make an interesting podcast.
It would. Yeah.
Yeah. Like a serial type of thing. Yeah. Yeah. There's something else I was going to bring up. We talked about the, let me look here real quick. Yeah. I wasn't texting or anything during this. Oh, The Night Of. So I think I told you there's a great new show on HBO. I don't know if you checked it out. Oh, you said you didn't have the HBO. It's worth it. It's worth the money to get the monthly subscription. Cause it's really, so it basically puts you in the shoes of a person who has a questionable charge put against them. And it brings you, like, you know, he had drugs in his system, and you see how he got the drugs in his system. He was a good kid. It was a pretty girl. She kind of nudged him into taking the, you know what I mean? It lets you kind of see that, all right, they find someone who's got drugs in their system, then first thing you think of is this guy's a crazed drug maniac, and sure, he killed the person, but he didn't do drugs. I mean, he did them that night, and it was just interesting. So I don't know, I'm giving HBO a plug. They get all the money they want, but it's a really cool show. I think you'd like it.
Yeah, I'd like to check it out.
And it's I think it's a series. I mean, it is a series, so you can't binge watch it, which kind of stinks. But I'm sure you can find it somewhere. So, Frank, anything you want to add in the end there? I see your gears are turning.
Just there's one more observation.
Okay.
I was talking about doing things right,
mm-hmm.
With prosecution. If they don't do things right, if somebody messes up and you can't tell and you convict them, then there's two things that happen, really. I mean, one, there's an innocent person sitting in jail or being punished, and there's somebody who did do the crime walking around.
Yeah.
And that's really what we want to avoid. That's why you have the whole system set up the way it is. And it works pretty well.
Yeah.
It works very well, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the system's not broken. You can have people in the system that make bad decisions, and that can have, you know, negative consequences.
Well, Trump tweeted today that the system is rigged. So comment.
Looks rigged to me.
Certain systems.
Yeah.
That system.
You can certainly get favorable treatment if you're in certain positions.
The Orwell quote. All something are created equal? It said one of the animals.
Yeah, you know,
is it all pigs are created equal? Some pigs are more.
Yeah. All animals are created equal.
Is that what it is?
Created more equal than others.
Yeah, that was, what an interesting day. I mean, I don't, we could spend another 45 minutes on that, but man, can you imagine the people that just put the last year of their life into investigating this to just have it go absolutely nowhere, just all that work, whew, gone.
Sometimes that happens, though.
Yeah.
You know, legitimately, sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't happen. That's a strange, it's all, a lot of it's political, that whole, the whole situation is mind-boggling. Yeah.
Well, I used to handle lots of classifieds, and I know that I watched them like a... I would have to make sure I had every page of every... If I tore a corner off, I had to find that thing when I was returning, because I would have had the book thrown at me if I mishandled classified information. But who is I? Just an officer. Yeah. All right, well... With that, we will end the show. Thanks, twistedpodcast.com, right?
Yes, thank you.
And then truecrimewriting.com. You can check out John Taylor both there. And if you need his books, you can just, if you need his books, if you want his books, you can go to Amazon or go through his site or go through my site. You'll find it on there. For every book he sells through my site, I get 10% of the proceeds, which I thought was very nice of him to offer me before. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Like us on facebook.com/WWI Podcast and at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.